With all the outsourcing of call centers and IT support to India, you might think most paperwork there is handled electronically. Well, in fact, an impressively large portion of the Indian economy still functions on actual paper. Piles and piles of paper documents. David Kestenbaum of NPR's Planet Money team was in New Delhi and brought back a really big book.
This book, I have it here, it's actually a ledger, and it's the most gigantic ledger I've ever seen. On the cover, it says PBR, for Pay Bill Register. It's intended for some government clerk keeping track of employees. And if you open it up, there are 40 columns for writing down overtime, license fee, motor conveyance advance, and oddly, there's a column for computer advance here on paper. It's kind of beautiful. And you can imagine, across the country, bureaucrats filling this book out and other books like it in very neat handwriting. Karan Thapar is a well-known television journalist, and he remembers the first time he saw government paperwork up close.
I remember going to the old income tax office way back in 76, walked into this room, and I was mesmerized because there, sitting in this dank, dingy, dark room, was this wee little mole of a creature buried in files, right? And then there were these stacks that went up all the way to the roof with mildewed brown files, decaying with age, brown with dust.
This is not the most efficient way to run a tax office, a city government, or anything. Thapar blames the Indian love of paperwork in part on the British. When India was a British colony, the Brits trained a generation of bureaucrats, and it gave them sometimes meaningless jobs filling out forms. The Brits left, but the paperwork stayed.
Our culture is obsessed with writing on files, sending papers, making notes, petitioning people. And then, of course, every file has to be signed upon on the left-hand side by everyone who's read it, and they all write their comments. And so you have two parallel files within each file, the file that contains the actual documents, and then the side issue where people are signing to say they've read it, and what they've read, and what it amounts to. It's a nightmare, a complete nightmare. I mean, the great dream of a paperless office doesn't exist in India. It's only talked about.
That story Thapar told was from the 1970s, so I went to visit a city government building in Delhi, and it was exactly as he had described from 30 years ago. Stacks of ledgers and documents, mountains of old paper. Outside on the street, I ran into Prakash Chanisharma, a student, who said, "Oh yeah, I had to go to court once. You should see the paper there."
There are some drawers or something. There are so much papers. Paper, paper, paper.
How do you think they find anything? How do they find anything that's in those files?
They know, sir. They are magical people.
They're magical people?
They are magical. They know everything.
To be fair, a lot of the world is still like this. In the United States, a lot of people still file their tax returns on paper. Waiters still scribble things down on a pad. But paperwork and unnecessary paperwork can really slow an economy down. I talked with people in India about this, people in business, in government, and economists. Why does red tape persist? One theory is that some people want it to. Who? Well, anyone who wants a bribe. You need my signature? Sure. But if you want it today... Another explanation was simply that governments move slowly. India has the world's largest and some would say most unwieldy democracy in the world. I decided at some point to try to find the red tape factory. There has to be a place where all those government ledgers come from. A guide took me into the maze of streets that is Old Delhi. You take a taxi to the edge, but then the streets are so narrow, you have to switch to a rickshaw pulled by a guy pedaling a bike. And somewhere in the maze, we find them, shop after shop selling paper, blank forms. They're stationary wholesalers. One store sells those giant government ledgers, and across the street, there's a store that specializes in something I hadn't seen in years, carbon paper. The owner is Kamaljeet Singh Bajaj. So where is all the carbon paper made in this country?
See, there are about 4 or 5 industrial hubs in and around Delhi. Okhla is one, Noida is one, Gurgaon, Manesar, then Kundli, Sonipat, and Wazirpur industrial area.
Is there a big market for it?
Actually, it's a dying industry, as you know. You know, people are going for computer and computerized billing. So over the last 30 years, I've seen a downfall by more than 75%.
Really?
There was a time when carbon was such a hot selling item, but now you see, not so much.
That's bad news for the carbon paper industry, maybe good news for everyone else. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
Today marks the last day that new homebuyers can qualify for an $8,000 federal tax credit. And a few weeks ago, the Federal Reserve wrapped up a program that was helping to keep mortgage rates low. The government has been trying to prevent another collapse of the housing market. With those measures gone, it'll be time to see whether the still weak market can walk on its own two feet. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
In a condo that's for sale in Waltham, Massachusetts, Sheila Doherty is checking out the kitchen and opening the closet doors.
Oh, it's a good size living closet.
This condo is listed at $225,000. Doherty's going over the details with her realtor, Anita Shishmanian.
Plus, they have a swimming pool here.
Right.
So it's pretty reasonable, actually.
Prices, of course, have been falling and getting more reasonable. Interest rates are still low. The data for April isn't available yet, but it sounds like the deadline for that $8,000 tax credit has definitely been getting some more people to buy homes. Doherty and her broker, Anita, say open houses have been full again, and nicer properties have been getting multiple offers.
Things that are on the market that are nice go under agreement immediately. Like, you see something on the market one minute, I call Anita, and then all of a sudden it's already gone.
They'll say, well, we just accepted an offer. So it's instantaneous. Yeah. It's just amazing.
Yeah, that sounds like a big change even from a couple of months ago.
Oh, very, yeah.
So all that might sound good for the housing market, and some areas are doing better than others. But the big question is, what's going to happen now that the $8,000 tax credit is going away?
That's a good question.
There's a lot riding on what happens next. For Anita Shishmanian, during April, all of the homes that she was listing sold within 2 weeks of coming on the market.
So that's got to be nice for realtors. I mean, all of a sudden you're making commissions again.
Yeah, so. Isn't that nice? A paycheck. It's been a long, hard couple of years. I mean, everybody's feeling the positive effects. Oops.
Shishmanian's phone is once again ringing all the time. And there's all sorts of other businesses that are hoping that it keeps ringing. There's door and window manufacturers, construction workers, electricians, stores like Home Depot. Spending on residential construction and other housing-related services has seen its steepest drop-off in more than 50 years. Recently, the market's been stabilizing, but it's hard to know how dependent it is on those federal stimulus efforts that are now ending.
It's really only once you kind of take that stimulus away that the curtain's pulled back and it's revealed whether or not you're going to see a drop-off in sales activity.
Jonathan Deanhart is the director of published research with Hanley Wood Market Intelligence, which tracks the housing market. He thinks we might see a bit of a slump after the tax credit expires. Many economists are predicting that prices could keep sliding, perhaps falling by another 5% nationally. But that's a lot less than the 30% price drops that we've already seen in many areas.
There's always a possibility that housing could continue to decline, but it has fallen sufficiently far that I think that even if there is kind of a continual drag along the bottom, we've probably still seen the worst of the declines. So I'm not concerned that things are going to drop off a cliff later this year.
But some other experts are concerned that there could be a more serious second dip in the housing market. There are now nearly 5 million homeowners who are at least 60 days delinquent and heading towards foreclosure. That's a record number of homes, and that could glut the market and keep pushing down prices. So some economists say preventing many of those foreclosures could still make a big difference. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
If you're sick of hearing about the iPad or the iPhone or anything with a lowercase I in front of it, well, apologies, because this next story is kind of about that. People who surf the web with these devices sometimes come across huge chunks of empty space where a video or a game should go. It's because Apple's mobile products don't support Flash. That's the technology that powers those parts of the web. Now, Apple's CEO, Steve Jobs, hates Flash. He even released an open letter Thursday explaining why. And because his iDevices don't support Flash, he's got some of the Internet's most popular destinations, the New York Times, Facebook, even us at NPR.org, working to strip Flash away from their websites. This isn't the first time Apple's taken aim at a mainstream technology, and Leander Caney has chronicled that history. He's the author of a number of books about Apple, including the Steve Jobs biography, Inside Steve's Brain, and he runs the website cultofmac.com. Leander Caney, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So why doesn't Steve Jobs at Apple like Flash? What does he have against it?
It's purely technical. It's not a very good program for mobile devices. It's CPU hog, and it drains battery life very quickly. So he doesn't want it on it.
I mean, let's just put it into perspective. Flash is the dominant multimedia technology out there right now, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It has amazing penetration. You know, most three-quarters of all the video on the net is encoded in Flash. Almost all of the games, all the casual games, especially the really popular games like Farmville and Facebook, they're all encoded in Flash. Almost all of the technology world is in bed with Flash. Almost all of it. It's kind of remarkable.
Now, if you go to the NPR website, for example, on your internet browser, the videos that you might see there, or the New York Times website, for example, are made using Flash. But if you use your iPad or your iPhone, you can still see the videos. NPR has essentially removed Flash for those mobile devices. I mean, that seems like Apple has a lot of power to push these kinds of changes.
Oh, absolutely, yes. It really does have a lot of power. It's quite remarkable. I spoke to one expert, and he said that 6 months ago he thought Flash was the future. He thought Flash had was the future of multimedia on the net. He says these days he thinks it's doomed.
Apple is often credited with being one of the driving forces, you know, sort of popularizing new technology like the mouse, but also helping to kill off other technologies. What are some other examples of things that Apple has sort of basically moved away from that have then gone off to die?
The floppy drive was a good example. In the late 90s when Steve Jobs introduced the first iMac. It came without a floppy drive. It had this new thing called a CD drive.
And that was the end of the floppy drive.
It was, yeah. Yeah, it was definitely the end of the floppy for most people.
And, of course, iTunes and the iPod are effectively, if they haven't already, basically killed the CD.
Right, absolutely. And another good example is even Blu-ray. There's been a lot of controversy about the lack of Blu-ray drives in its Macintosh computers, but Apple says you can already get a lot of really high-def content streaming over the internet. And, of course, this is where, you know, everyone knows that this is where it's eventually going to go, but they're pushing that envelope already.
Is there anything about this that suggests it is about power?
I don't think so. Jobs is a very curious character because he is so private. A lot of people love to think of him as this sort of cat-stroking villain in a volcano lair who is hatching evil plans. But I think he is genuinely interested in crafting technology that is easy to use for consumers. And Flash wrecks that experience, or has the potential to wreck that experience. And so it's gone. He's just extremely ruthless about that.
That's Leander Caney. He runs the website cultofmac.com. We spoke with him from KQED in San Francisco. Leander Caney, thanks so much.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block. An aid package to keep Greece from defaulting on its debt is still being hammered out. It's expected that the Greek government, European Union officials, and the International Monetary Fund will complete a rescue plan over the weekend. Many Americans worry about the size of U.S. deficits, and NPR's John Idstey takes a look at whether the U.S. could suffer a similar crisis.
There was lots of sober talk about exploding government debt around Washington this week, and it wasn't just about Greece. President Obama's debt commission held its first meeting on Tuesday. It's supposed to come up with ideas to curb record U.S. deficits and debt. The next day, at a big public symposium, former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin raised the Greek issue.
We are massively different. We are not remotely like the situations in Greece, Portugal, and other countries of Europe. But I do think we should try to learn from that how important it is to make sure that we never face anything even remotely like what they're facing right now.
But Carmen Reinhart, an economist at the University of Maryland, thinks Americans might be too complacent.
Countries time and time again allow themselves to be positioned in very vulnerable situations because they think the crises are things that happen to others, not to us.
A U.S. crisis could look a lot like what's threatening Greece, says Reinhart. A refusal by lenders to lend, dramatic cuts in government benefits, and serious damage to our economy.
A Greek scenario is not something that is around the corner for the United States at this stage. However, let it go unchecked.
And the consequences might surprise you. But former Federal Reserve Vice Chairman Alan Blinder thinks a Greek ending to the U.S. debt drama is unlikely.
The differences, to me, outweigh the similarities.
One difference, says Blinder, now a Princeton professor, is that Greece's debt, relative to the size of its economy, is almost double that of the U.S. That said, U.S. debt could end up just as high in the future if we don't control our deficits. But there's one really crucial difference between the U.S. and Greece, says Blinder. The U.S. has its own currency. The Greeks gave up theirs when they adopted the euro.
If Greece was not part of the eurozone, the drachma, which is what it was called, would have already depreciated substantially. That would be giving a boost to Greek exports and to the Greek economy.
And when the drachma depreciated, it would have also reduced the real value of Greek debt. Most of that debt would probably have been denominated in drachmas, so Greece would have paid it back with cheaper money. But Greece can't depreciate the euro, so it can't reduce its debt in that backdoor kind of way. However, having its own currency doesn't mean the U.S. won't face serious consequences if it doesn't get control of its finances, says Blinder.
I think we'll pay the piper in two main dimensions. One is considerably higher interest rates than we have now.
Lenders will see more risk in holding U.S. bonds precisely because the U.S. might decide to allow or even encourage a slide in the dollar to erode the value of U.S. debts. And if lenders demanded higher interest rates to lend the U.S. government money, the rest of us would have to pay higher rates, too, for our mortgages and car loans and business loans. The other effect, a fall in the value of the dollar, would also hurt regular folks, says Blinder.
Broadly speaking, the U.S. standard of living declines because the way we measure standard of living, conventionally, has to do with the purchasing power of the money you earn.
Blinder and Reinhardt agree the way to avoid a crisis is obvious, some combination of tax hikes and spending cuts. But politically, the solution is very difficult. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.